Welcome to the Voice of America's Learning English, a 30-minute show designed for English learners. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, we listen to another segment of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Later, Phil Dierking and Kelly Jean Kelly tell us about St. Patrick's Day. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. But first, a report from Ashley Thompson and me. National Geographic magazine admitted this week that racism had influenced its reporting on the world for generations. The head of National Geographic was critical of its images of bare-breasted women. She rejected descriptions of brown-skinned tribesmen as savage and unintelligent. "We had to own our story to move beyond it," editor-in-chief Susan Goldberg told the Associated Press. She was speaking about the magazine's April edition, which explores the issue of race. The National Geographic Society, a not-for-profit organization, first published its magazine in 1888.
John Edwin Mason, a photography historian, investigated National Geographic's reporting and choice of photos over the years. He teaches African history and the history of photography at the University of Virginia. Mason reported his findings to the magazine in late 2017. His study found that, until the 1970s, National Geographic largely ignored people of color in the United States unless they were laborers or domestic servants. It often supported the idea that people of color from foreign lands were exotics, famously and frequently unclothed, happy hunters, noble savages, every type of cliché, Mason said. For example, in a 1916 story about Australia, a sentence next to a photo of two Aboriginal people read, "South Australian blackfellows. These savages rank lowest in intelligence of all human beings."
This examination comes as other media organizations are also considering their past reporting work. The New York Times recently admitted that most of its obituaries described the lives of white men. The newspaper began publishing stories on famous women in an area called Overlooked. It launched the project on March 8th, International Women's Day. The April edition of National Geographic included a letter from Goldberg. Goldberg said in the letter that, "When the editors decided to examine the subject of race, we thought we should examine our own history before turning our repertorial gaze to others." She told the AP, "I knew when we looked back there would be some storytelling that we obviously would never do today, that we don't do, and we're not proud of." Mason said his investigation found repeated examples of racist imagery in the magazine's representation of people of color. People of color were often pictured as living as their ancestors might have lived several hundreds of years ago, and that's in contrast to Westerners, who are always fully clothed and often carrying technology. Boys and men, Mason said, could count on every issue or two of National Geographic having some brown skin, bare breasts for them to look at. He said he believes that the editors knew that such imagery was one of the appeals of their magazine. Women, especially those from Pacific Islands, were photographed in ways that were almost glamour shots, Mason said.
Samir Husni heads the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi's Journalism School. He said many Americans first learned about the rest of the world by reading National Geographic. Husni said it is important that kind of coverage never happens again. He added that offering jobs in the magazine field to people from all backgrounds is a way to apologize for the past. Goldberg said she is doing just that. She noted that National Geographic has done a better job of employing women than members of racial and ethnic minority groups. National Geographic now reaches 30 million people around the world. It was one of the first magazines to publish color photos. The monthly magazine is well known for its coverage of history, science, environmentalism, and culture. It can currently be found in 172 countries and in 43 languages.
On March 17th, people around the world celebrate the Irish holiday of St. Patrick's Day. It is a major holiday in Ireland, but the rest of the world has influenced its celebration as much as the Irish themselves. Most Americans think of St. Patrick's Day as a big party centered around drinking alcohol. But its beginnings in Ireland were religious, says Mike Cronin, a professor of Irish history with Boston College of Massachusetts. Ireland is a mostly Roman Catholic country. St. Patrick lived in Ireland more than 2,000 years ago. He is widely considered to have established Christianity in the country. The church honored him with a holy day in the 17th century. March 17th marks the date of his death. St. Patrick, a Briton reportedly, is believed to have served in Ireland as a Catholic bishop. One traditional story says that St. Patrick drove all the snakes out of Ireland. The average Irish person honored March 17th quietly. Attending church services was the main activity. In fact, most businesses that served alcohol would close in honor of the day. In the early 1900s, Ireland's government made St. Patrick's Day an official holiday. By the 1960s, towns across Ireland started celebrating the holiday with parades and music. In Ireland today, St. Patrick's Day is a four-day public celebration that includes parades, music, food, and games.
For Irish people living outside Ireland, St. Patrick's Day became a chance to celebrate their Irish identity and culture. It's very much a day by which the Irish put themselves center stage, Cronin said. Now, countries and cities around the world celebrate March 17th in creative ways. Many countries hold St. Patrick's Day parades. Famous monuments, including the Great Wall of China, the Colosseum in Rome, the Niagara Falls, and the Gateway of India in Mumbai, will all be colored by green light for the day. The U.S. is especially famous for its St. Patrick's Day celebrations, Many cities with large ethnic Irish communities, like Boston, New York, and Chicago, hold parades and parties. Cities will also color local rivers green for the day. Ireland is known as the Emerald Isle. The country is covered in deep green grass. Cronin says that the worldwide popularity of St. Patrick's Day has helped the Irish government, which uses the holiday as a form of diplomacy.
So what you have is this quite remarkable day, where literally for much of the globe, everybody, whether they're Irish or not, the one thing they do know is the 17th of March is St. Patrick's Day. And for a small island of, you know, 4.5 million people, it's quite remarkable that they have that kind of soft power.
However, Cronin says many modern St. Patrick's Day traditions were invented by the Irish in America. In the U.S., on St. Patrick's Day, it is common for Americans to drink green beer or eat corned beef and cabbage. However, Cronin says many of these traditions are not really Irish. You could walk around the streets of Dublin all day and not find any corned beef and cabbage, he said. Neil O'Flaherty, an Irish citizen now living in the U.S., agrees. Growing up in a small town in Ireland, O'Flaherty remembers celebrating St. Patrick's Day much differently than it is now.
Back then, for Catholic families, it was the day when you had to go to church. You were required to go to Mass on that day. It had much more the feeling of a religious holiday than a public holiday.
He also remembers everyone wearing small, three-leaf plant pieces called shamrocks. O'Flaherty said that he was surprised to see how much St. Patrick's Day in the U.S. has become linked to drinking lots of beer or other alcoholic drinks. However, there are some Irish connections between drinking and St. Patrick's Day. One tradition that does come from Ireland is called drowning the shamrock. Cronin explains that this tradition involved taking the shamrock that people wore all day and placing it in a glass of whiskey or beer before drinking it. Professor Mike Cronin suggests it is not that important how people celebrate March 17th. He calls St. Patrick's Day a day for everyone to be Irish. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
Next up, we listen to part of another What It Takes podcast. Here is host Alice Winkler.
Wynton Marsalis once called music the art of the invisible, and he said the notes were infused with a magical essence.
It's like the feeling of I love you before the words, or the crest of a kiss before you even pucker your lips. Well, in jazz, we call this soul, and no one really knows what soul means. The only thing we know about soul is that you feel much better after you've come in contact with it than you felt before it was present.
Wynton Marsalis should know. He is the best-known jazz musician of our times. He's also a classical musician and a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and managing and artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center. He's all that and a bag of chips. And he is the subject of this episode of What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Here's trumpet player Wynton Marsalis in 1991, describing where the music he hears in his head comes from.
Whenever I see myself in a situation, I meet a new person or something, I wonder what they would sound like in music or something that's ironic or funny. Or if you go to the zoo and you look at animals, they have a musical type. Or colors, you know, so much stuff can be related to music. It can be the type of shoes somebody has on, or maybe it's the way you do this with your mustache, you know, it's like a question. Maybe it's like a phrase that goes, It could be anything. The type of clothing people wear, earrings, or the way a woman will move. You know, she might touch her lips a certain way, or look, move her eyes a certain way, or look at you a certain way. Or paintings, like sometimes I go to Modern Museum of Art, I get books of paintings of Romare Bearden, Picasso, Titian, Goya. It doesn't make a difference what the period is. And or reading a book, like, I remember once I was reading the Iliad, and I thought, boy, you could make some music out of this. Tunes for each character. It's just anything.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Here is Shep O'Neill with Pigs is Pigs by Ellis Parker Butler.
Mike Flannery, the agent of the Interurban Express Company, leaned over the desk in the company's office in Westcott and shook his fist. Mr. Morehouse, angry and red, stood on the other side of the desk, shaking with fury. The argument had been long and hot. At last, Mr. Morehouse had become speechless. The cause of the trouble lay on the desk between the two men. It was a box with two guinea pigs inside. "Do as you like, then," shouted Flannery. "Pay for them and take them, or don't pay for them and leave them here. Rules are rules, Mr. Morehouse, and Mike Flannery is not going to break them." "But you stupid idiot," shouted Mr. Morehouse, madly shaking a thin book beneath the agent's nose. "Can't you read it here, in your own book of transportation rates? Pets, domestic, Franklin to Westcott, if correctly boxed, 25 cents each." He threw the book on the desk. "What more do you want? Aren't they pets? Aren't they domestic? Aren't they correctly boxed? What?" He turned and walked back and forth rapidly with a furious look on his face. "Pets," he said. "P-E-T-S. 25 cents each. 2 times 25 is 50. Can you understand that? I offer you 50 cents. Flannery reached for the book. He ran his hand through the pages and stopped at page 64. "I don't take 50 cents, he whispered in an unpleasant voice. "Here's the rule for it. When the agent be in any doubt about which two rates should be charged on a shipment, he shall charge the larger. The person receiving the shipment may put in a claim for the overcharge. In this case, Mr. Morehouse, I be in doubt. Pets them animals may be, and domestic they may be, but pigs I'm sure they do be. And my rule says, plain as the nose on your face, pigs, Franklin to Westcott, 30 cents each." Mr. Morehouse shook his head savagely. "Nonsense," he shouted. "Confounded nonsense, I tell you. That rule means common pigs, not guinea pigs." "Pigs is pigs," Flannery said firmly. Mr. Morehouse bit his lip and then flung his arms out wildly. "Very well," he shouted. "You shall hear of this. Your president shall hear of this. It is an outrage. I have offered you 50 cents. You refuse it. Keep the pigs until you are ready to take the 50 cents. But by George, sir, if one hair of those pigs' heads is harmed, I will have the law on you. He turned and walked out, slamming the door. Flannery carefully lifted the box from the desk and put it in a corner. Mr. Morehouse quickly wrote a letter to the president of the Transportation Express Company. The president answered, informing Mr. Morehouse that all claims for overcharge should be sent to the Claims Department. Mr. Morehouse wrote to the Claims Department. 1 week later, he received an answer. The Claims Department said it had discussed the matter with the agent at Westcott. The agent said Mr. Morehouse had refused to accept the 2 guinea pigs shipped to him. Therefore, the department said, Mr. Morehouse had no claim against the company and should write to its tariff department. Mr. Morehouse wrote to the tariff department. He stated his case clearly. The head of the tariff department read Mr. Morehouse's letter. Huh, guinea pigs, he said. Probably starved to death by this time. He wrote to the agent asking why the shipment was held up. He also wanted to know if the guinea pigs were still in good health. Before answering, Agent Flannery wanted to make sure his report was up to date. So he went to the back of the office and looked into the cage. Good Lord, there were now 8 of them, all well and eating like hippopotamuses. He went back to the office and explained to the head of the tariff department what the rules said about pigs. And as for the condition of the guinea pigs, said Flannery, they were all well. But there were 8 of them now, all good eaters. The head of the tariff department laughed when he read Flannery's letter. He read it again and became serious. By George, he said, Flannery is right. Pigs is pigs. I'll have to get something official on this. He spoke to the president of the company. The president treated the matter lightly. What is the rate on pigs and on pets? He asked. Pigs, 30 cents. Pets, 25, the head of the tariff department answered. Then, of course, guinea pigs are pigs, the president said. Yes, the head of the tariff department agreed. I look at it that way, too. A thing that can come under 2 rates is naturally to be charged at the higher one. But are guinea pigs pigs? Aren't they rabbits? Come to think of it, the president said, I believe they are more like rabbits, sort of halfway between pig and rabbit. I think the question is this. Are guinea pigs of the domestic pig family? I'll ask Professor Gordon. He is an expert about such things. The president wrote to Professor Gordon. Unfortunately, the professor was in South America, collecting zoological samples. His wife forwarded the letter to him. The professor was in the high Andes Mountains. The letter took many months to reach him. In time, the president forgot the guinea pigs. The head of the tariff department forgot them. Mr. Morehouse forgot them. But Agent Flannery did not. The guinea pigs had increased to 32. He asked the head of the traffic department what he should do with them. "Don't sell the pigs," Agent Flannery was told. "They are not your property. Take care of them until the case is settled." The guinea pigs needed more room. Flannery made a large and airy room for them in the back of his office. Some months later, he discovered he now had 160 of them. He was going out of his mind. Not long after this, the president of the express company heard from Professor Gordon. It was a long and scholarly letter. It pointed out that the guinea pig was the Cavia aporia, while the common pig was the genus Sus of the family Suidae. The president then told the head of the traffic department that guinea pigs are not pigs and must be charged only 25 cents as domestic pets. The traffic department informed Agent Flannery that he should take the 160 guinea pigs to Mr. Morehouse and collect 25 cents for each of them. Agent Flannery wired back, "I've got 800 now. Shall I collect for 800 or what? How about the $64 I paid for cabbages to feed them?" Many letters went back and forth. Flannery was crowded into a few feet at the extreme front of the office. The guinea pigs had all the rest of the room. Time kept moving on as the letters continued to go back and forth. Flannery now had 4,064 guinea pigs. He was beginning to lose control of himself. Then he got a telegram from the company that said, "Error in guinea pig bill. Collect for two guinea pigs 50 cents. Flannery ran all the way to Mr. Morehouse's home, but Mr. Morehouse had moved. Flannery searched for him in town, but without success. He returned to the express office and found that 206 guinea pigs had entered the world since he left the office. At last, he got an urgent telegram from the main office. "Send the pigs to the main office of the company at Franklin." Flannery did so. Soon came another telegram. "Stop sending pigs. Warehouse full." But he kept sending them. Agent Flannery finally got free of the guinea pigs. "Rules may be rules," he said, "but so long as Flannery runs this express office, pigs is pets, and cows is pets, and horses is pets, and lions and tigers and Rocky Mountain goats is pets, and the rate on them is 25 cents. Then he looked around and said cheerfully, "Well, anyhow, it is not as bad as it might have been. What if them guinea pigs had been elephants?"
We have come to the end of today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.